This is Don Hussig with Cancer Action Network. You're listening to Loving the Earth Pollution Free Revolution. And joining us today is a very important voice in the whole realm of the use of science to prevent cancer, especially with a focus on chemical carcinogenesis. Good morning, Dr. Cagliano.
Good morning.
Would you introduce yourself for our listeners?
Okay, my name is Vincent Cagliano. I'm the head of the IARC Monograph Program at the International Agency for Research on Cancer. The International Agency for Research on Cancer is a part of the World Health Organization, or the Cancer Research Agency of the World Health Organization. And the IARC monographs are a series of scientific reviews that identify causes of human cancer. And they're used by national governments in their efforts to identify what causes of cancer are useful for them to control.
I see. Basically, gleaning information from the scientific literature that can be used to prevent cancers when that is possible and control cancers when the prevention message isn't continues to not be extant in the literature.
That's right. We review the epidemiological studies and the experimental studies on any particular topic, and we try to determine if those studies as a whole indicate that something is a cancer risk or is a possible cancer risk or that it should not be considered a cancer risk at this time.
Understood. Part 3 of the U.S. EPA dioxin reassessment includes a risk characterization. What is the purpose? Can you just explain for the general public what the purpose of producing a risk characterization for dioxin exposure is?
A risk characterization is bringing together all of the different disciplines that are involved in a risk assessment, the epidemiology, the toxicology, the other experimental sciences, the cancer effects, the reproductive effects, the developmental effects, neurotoxic effects, and it tries to put it all in perspective to say what are the adverse health effects that you might expect from a chemical like dioxin, which ones have been well studied and that there's a good consensus on, which ones have been less studied and there's some suggestions but maybe not a clear signal. They look at the dose response information to try to get a sense of how much exposure will produce what levels of effects. And risk characterization can also go through the sources of exposure and the levels of exposure of the general population or specific population to try to estimate what kind of health impacts that population might have.
Okay, that's very well put. I think you've explained that fully sufficiently to make it possible for, you know, any of the listeners to understand what we're talking about here. And based upon what I have seen in this matter of using science to prevent cancer with regards to dealing with the science of dioxin and dioxin-like compound exposure, the risk characterization is so very important. This, it's to tighten up a little bit further. The risk characterization that was done by USAPA, it was a very quantitative type of endeavor. And so what you mentioned about being able to assess population level effects of a certain amount of exposure to particular pollutant carcinogens, what is the, can the risk characterization, which is set forth in the USAPA's dioxin reassessment, which includes the determination of a cancer risk slope factor, can that risk characterization and that cancer risk slope factor and the other data that exists in the USAPA dioxin reassessment, can that be used to calculate population-level cancer risk?
That's the purpose of the slope factor. The slope factor, for listeners who may not be familiar with that technical term, is basically tells you how many cancer cases you might expect from a particular level of exposure, say like 1 picogram per kilogram body weight per day. And so if somebody's exposed to more or less than that level of 1 picogram per kilogram body weight per day, you can calculate what their cancer risk might be, and you can multiply that by the number of people that are exposed that way to get a number of cancer cases. One thing I should mention, though, is that slope factors are generally calculated from the more sensitive animal studies, and they're intended to be an upper bound. So there is a reasonable expectation that the number of cancer cases you calculate is a bit of an upper bound to the actual number of cancer cases you might expect.
Okay. Well, you see, I had read that upper bound, you know, kind of qualifier on the cancer risk slope factor and the population level, you know, amounts of cancer outcome were being described in the EPA's action assessment. And I followed up on it, and I talked to Dr. Rodin and Dr. Birnbaum, who at the time I was, you know, at that stage with, you know, the dioxin assessment, they were there with EPA doing that work. And I clearly recall that, I think it was Dr. Rodin, he stated that that was more, the upper bound truly was almost more this kind of political kind of message, because truly I had looked at, you know, what EPA used to come up with their cancer risk slope factor, and they were largely basing it upon the epidemiological studies of the German factory workers who were exposed to the dioxin contaminate in the manufacture of certain pesticides. And when one looks at that and then looks at how much exposure was in the various groups of the exposed, there wasn't all that much of a difference between the low end of the factory workers' exposure and the high end of the public's average general exposure just to the background levels in the food supply. And so there wasn't at all this matter of, you know, the uncertainty being introduced by much of an extrapolation, you know, from the where the factory worker data ended and you went down to the levels where, you know, the public exposure started. And there's also this whole matter of, it's just that there wasn't that, I'm losing my thread for some reason here at this moment. You were saying, what did you just say that it was kind of like triggering me, you know, getting to this? Oh, about the upper bound, about the upper bound.
Yeah.
There wasn't that lack of, there wasn't that uncertainty. And see, it wasn't animal studies either. It wasn't the, you know, the animal results. And this wasn't something that was more sensitive. You stated that it was a more sensitive population. Well, see, this was with people. They're basing their, you know, their determination of the cancer risk slope factor largely on epidemiological studies. And so we're talking about the same kinds of sensitivities. Certainly I don't see why the factory workers would have been any more sensitive to dioxin exposure than the average American or the average, you know, world resident.
No, I'm actually not saying that factory workers are likely to be more sensitive, but I think that when you look at all the epidemiological studies, you tend to take the ones where the exposures have been measured well, the risks are fairly well known, and if you have several studies to choose from, and you do with dioxin, you often do still take the study that shows an upper end of risks when you're trying to estimate what the slope factor would be and what might be the risk to a general population.
Okay.
I will agree with you that a lot of the features of the dioxin database, because there are so many studies and because the low end of exposures in some of the industrial worker studies is really fairly close to the, like within a factor of 10 maybe, of what background levels in the general population are, that we're not talking about large levels of extrapolation to, you know, to low levels of a chemical. We're talking about observation that's not too far removed from what people are exposed to.
Okay. So we are in agreement also upon the fact that the cancer risk slope factor can be used to calculate population level cancer risk?
Yes. Okay. I would say to estimate.
Yes. Okay. Well, then, based upon the risk characterization set forth in the US EPA dioxin reassessment, what would you calculate as being the estimated number of cancer cases that will be caused by dioxin exposure in the world during the upcoming 70 years?
EPA gives you the estimate that at current background levels of exposure, the cancer risk is about 1 in 1,000 for people exposed at the average level in the U.S., and you can multiply that by the population to get a predicted number of cancer cases. Now, extrapolating that to the world, I think I have a bit of problem with, because I just don't know how those exposures translate into average levels of exposure elsewhere in the world. Certainly, there's going to be other areas that are higher, but there's others that might be lower. And I don't think I've ever seen a comprehensive survey of dioxin exposures around the world.
Okay, then just kind of jumping back, you know, lowering our kind of like reach here as far as the estimate, what would the total then be for just the U.S.?
Well, if you wanted to multiply a population of 300 million times the risk of 1 per 1,000, that would come to 300,000 cancer cases.
Okay.
Again, as an upper bound, and that also would assume that exposure levels stay fairly constant.
Okay. During the past several years, scientific research has been published describing predisposition to increased cancer susceptibility, both breast cancer susceptibility in females and prostate cancer susceptibility in males. And this is in animal models, resulting from gestational dioxin exposure. Do these research findings merit a reevaluation of dioxin exposure cancer risk pursuant to developing a tolerable monthly intake for dioxins?
I think they do. I mean, you should always be looking at the complete database. And I think one of the things to keep in mind for a lot of our epidemiological studies are based on workers. So they're generally people who are at least 18 years old into their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. So they're not going through rapid physical development while they're doing their job. And the animal studies that we see as well, usually the animals are several weeks old, which means they are physically and sexually mature when exposure starts. So when we do have a signal that there might be some period of susceptibility during development or earlier in life, it does merit looking at that, because that generally has not been the way epidemiological studies or studies in rats and mice are done.
Okay. How might the gestational exposure referred to above, you know, in this previous question, how might that gestational exposure to dioxins influence the number of cancer cases caused by dioxin exposure? And see, what I'm getting at there is we don't really know how many cancer cases are caused by dioxin exposure, but certainly that is an actual, real kind of issue. It's a real actuality. It's an actuality. There are a certain number of cancer cases that are caused by dioxin exposure, and we're trying to figure that out. How might that number change? We would come closer to knowing the true number, you know, the true and correct number of cancer cases caused by dioxin exposure. How might this, you know, this gestational exposure matter, you know, change the numbers, and, you know, what would that lead to?
Well, if the gestational exposure is indeed a period of, during a period of higher susceptibility, you would expect the cancer risks to be higher than the ones that are developed based on estimates of workplace exposure. I don't think we can really quantify at this point how much higher that would be or what other factors may come into play, but I think it does raise a concern that there is a case to be made that the risks could be higher based on these newer studies.
So in other words, what that means is that the cancer risk slope factor that EPA currently has based on these factory workers may well lead to an underestimate of total dioxin-caused cancer cases?
At least in the case of people exposed during gestation.
Yep,
it may
yep,
be still
yep,
a good
exactly.
predictor for
yep.
what you and I might have as a cancer risk based on the traces we get in our foods or from other sources.
Yep. But considering the fact that you and I were both exposed gestationally, I have to think that if these animal studies are, you know, a window on what happens with people's bodies when they're, you know, exposed to these various stages of development, that then we would have to kind of keep in mind that for our lifetime, and, you know, for like the cancer case we've got going, you know, if we do have one going to one limited degree or more degree, whatever the case may be, that we would actually be at more than a 1 in 1,000 risk, you know, kind of like considering our whole exposure history.
That's I mean, that is a plausible possibility, and it is something that is perhaps open to investigation scientifically. I mean, you could look for a cohort of people, children who had higher than average gestational exposure, and you can follow them, and you can look for some of the preclinical markers of breast cancer. Prostate cancer generally shows up so late in life, that study would probably take a long time to have any conclusive results.
In New York State, during the time period 2002 through 2006, 12 girls ages 15 through 19 were diagnosed with breast cancer. A 10-year-old California girl was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2009. If gestational dioxin exposure imposes increased cancer susceptibility in humans, just as it has been found to do in female rats, could this increased cancer susceptibility be involved in causing girls as young as 10 years of age to develop breast cancer?
I think that's a hypothesis that you can test scientifically, though I would also want to investigate these 10 girls, look and see whether they were carriers of one of the breast cancer genes, and look at any other exposures that might be plausible.
Okay.
I mean, you would want to know that these girls really did have a higher than normal, higher than average dioxin exposure, and that there were no other hormonal factors or other things that might be implicated in breast cancer.
Okay. Well, just help me understand this a little more fully. See, the way I looked at it was I just thought, okay, if dioxin exposure truly does impose more cancer risk, taking into account this new science of the gestational exposure outcome, then why wouldn't it just be the case that there were larger total numbers, kind of like, and say if you graph that, you have this like bell curve, this normal kind of distribution type thing for the cancer cases that are caused by dioxin exposure, wouldn't you just tend to have more at every place on that, curve and under that curve? And so that, a plausible explanation could be that these girls wouldn't have had any higher dioxin exposure. It would just be that there'd be more people that ended up getting cancer earlier in life because there were just more cancer cases under that curve.
I think that would be one of the outcomes you would predict, but I would still want to, when I have some identifiable cases of cancer, I would really want to look at some of the other risk factors for breast cancer. And certainly, different hormones do have a role in breast cancer development, as well as dioxin. And so, I would want to. It would be the type of scientific study that you could set up a testable hypothesis. You could say, we're going to look at all the known factors or the reasonably suspected factors that are implicated in breast cancer, and we can see which ones these girls had.
Well, tell me, just while we're talking about that a little more, see, we're going to this a little more fully than one. I was just kind of thinking through the interview. We're in the process, our Cancer Action New York group is in the process of making a request to the New York State Department of Health that they would conduct an investigation such as what you're describing right there for these 12 girls in New York State that were diagnosed, and for, well, there's been a considerable number of years since 2006. I'm sure they would have, certainly more than 12 young women to be part of this study. And we're just hoping that they will do this, and you're saying that you think it would be a good idea, so, I think I will mention that to them. Because they do hesitate to do this kind of research over here. And I'm just so glad, you can't imagine how much more pleasant it is to speak with you about the US EPA dioxin reassessment than it is to speak with the EPA people. They were just so nasty, for lack of a better word. They didn't want to. They actually stated that the cancer risk slope factor was meaningless. They stated that it was impossible to use the risk quantification set forth in the dioxin reassessment in Part 3 to estimate population level cancer risk. I was just shocked when there was backtracking on what they had created with their scientific endeavors. It was like the politicians didn't want to hear it, so they were really, really backing down. And I'm just so glad that you are willing to say what is reasonable about this. It's everybody I talk to that's a scientist says, yeah, that's the way it is. What you say is the way it is.
I have a lot of sympathy for people who work for government agencies and government health departments because I mean, everything they say is scrutinized by lots of different kinds of parties. And I mean, some of the calculations that go into these slope factors, some of the judgments in selecting which studies you use, you even though you're measuring cancers in a cohort of factory workers who are exposed to dioxin on the job, they're also exposed to other chemicals. And
right.
There are assumptions you have to make about how much of this cancer is attributable to dioxin, how much is it attributable to other chemicals they're exposed to, and how much is it attributable to just other factors that we're all exposed to that contribute to about one in three of us developing cancer in our lifetime. So there's a lot of these uncertainties there. And so, like, even though I went through the math with you and I took 1 in 1,000 times 300 million, I don't really believe that there will be 300,000 cancer cases in the U.S. based on dioxin. I think that there will be some. But there are a lot of judgments that went into it that would make the numbers be higher or lower. And you don't want to necessarily provoke a headline that...
But just tell me, can you explain to me why you would not suspect that to be the case when we've just been talking about the fact that the cancer risk slope factor is probably too small a number and the cancer cases could well be larger than what, you know, is estimated because of the gestational exposure matter?
Well, scientists do want to be fairly sure of statements they make.
Yep.
And I'll be able to tell you that... There are great differences between species in development.
Yep.
I mean, you can just see this when you see a horse being born and the horse stands up. Our baby, you know, a human baby can't do that.
Yep.
So, you know, what a particular stage of gestation in a rat means compared with a similar exposure in a human, there may be differences. And the studies you described in rats certainly do raise some concerns, and they ought to be explored further. But I think that I wouldn't right now want to say that the slope factor is an underestimate.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
It's something that needs to be investigated. So I think sometimes you see, you know, government officials do need to be very careful that people understand all of the limitations in the data that we have, and how that prediction of 300,000 cases here is really very difficult to.
But see, the difference is you have been so pleasant and nice and reasonable behaving about it. I'm not swearing at you. And the truth is, when I was done with that Dr. Proust, you know, he wanted it, and I gave it to him, and I kind of regret it, but I get a little bit of an attitude and a little bit of a temper. And so when he was just, like, pushing all my buttons, you know, about something that's so important as dioxin exposure cancer risk and quantification and all this, they've been reassessing dioxin since April of 1991. We're, like, 19 years out on this. And, you know, I just think about how many people are dying without, you know, the good knowledge. And so, you know, I certainly wasn't, you know, just kind of, you know, just floating around talking to this guy and, you know, just on cloud nine or anything. I did feel kind of, you know, concerned about this lack of due diligence on the part of the US EPA and all the bad history I've had with them through the years of my activism here in the U.S. But you are so super different than they are. I think I'm going to quit talking to Americans.
No.
It's just amazing.
No, I'm not really different.
Yes, you are.
I know what
the guy was like. He was mean about it, and he was just trying to, you know, he didn't like what you said about there are some uncertainties, and then we could talk about those uncertainties. He didn't do that. He just started out with, like, childlike arithmetic and nonsense, and it was pretty obvious that he was way off the page.
I think that most government scientists really do know these uncertainties. I think
he knows it. Tom, he knows it.
Yeah, they do know it. Part of the problem is that there is also a very political process by which government reports are reviewed and released. And I know the process in the U.S. for the National Toxicology Program's report on carcinogens, the process that U.S. EPA goes through, is open to a lot of public comment, and not all of the public comments are fully disclosed. And so there are constraints on what a government official can say before the document's been cleared for publication, because then it appears that government officials have prejudged prejudged the issue before they've received the scientific review or the clearance of the report. So there are some constraints based on the political process that's imposed on these evaluations, and I'm sure you're aware that there has been a lot of political interference over the last several years on what kinds of reports could be released. And
we simply tried to obtain the documentation of the Science Advisory Board that advises EPA on scientific matters, and that they were the main player in getting the dioxin reassessment further along. We simply tried to obtain through FOIA, this Freedom of Information Act that exists here in the U.S., this national law of access to information for the public, we simply tried to obtain the records of any letters, any correspondence, any notes, any voicemails, any messages, any kind of contact between the Science Advisory Board and, any stakeholder, say, the National Cattlemen's Association or the Dairy Association or any of these food, the guys that got the money that don't want to stop selling animal fat. We tried to obtain that information. It's Dwayne Winters, who's the head of the Dioxin Policy Project, he stated to me, he sent me a letter and he put in writing that there was no documentation, nothing existed other than the names of the people that, had, or stakeholders, basically. It was unreal. I'd probably do it again, just FOIA them again, like 10 years later and see if the political situation has changed enough that they would be willing to provide that kind of information. But anyways, I got
that shows you, though, the difficulty I think a lot of government officials are under, that in some cases the records may not exist, in other cases
I'll bet they exist.
There are exemptions to, because you do want your government officials to be able to debate is this study valid, isn't this study valid, and you want them to be able to write internal memos back and forth, you want them to be able to critique each other's work without feeling that every comment they make is going to then be pulled into a court, and they'll say, well, why did you say this other study wasn't very good?
I don't think that's a good idea.
So I think government officials are under a lot of competing demands, and I think that they do know what they're doing, and I think they do want to help as much as possible, but there are often political constrictions about not being able to give results out before the scientifically cleared.
I was just asking for the history of the animal fat industry's contact with the Science Advisory Board. I wasn't asking for a record
and
documentation of what the scientists were saying.
And those kinds of records really ought to be.
They should.
There have been a lot of other cases of who met with the top officials in the White House on energy policy, and those records a lot of people have wanted, and it's been difficult to get those. But I'd like you to really understand that there are a lot of civil servants want to do the right thing. That's why they're in civil service, and it's sometimes very difficult to balance all of the constraints.
I should try to change my mind. Based on your good example, because you certainly are a civil servant. I should try to change my mind. But I have this expression that's going to be hard to give up. I actually have come to call these U.S. civil servants, especially in the EPA, as these lapdogs of the abusive corporate overlords. But I can tone it down, I'm sure, with some good experiences like what you're giving me today. I have another question for you.
Yeah, I think most people go to work for federal agencies like EPA because they do want to do good for the public. And I think that scientific questions are not always very clear-cut. And so you do see, there's studies that increase your concern, but there's some shortcomings in these studies.
Yep.
And,
Well, the fact of the matter is we just can't just try to understand this perfectly beyond reasonable levels of perfection, considering how complex and undecipherable so much of it truly is. It will be so unwise to not act in precaution and let people continue to consume just the whatever they choose, you know, however much they desire to eat of animal fat, considering what is known in the science. And EPA is certainly not doing a very good job of getting that knowledge out to the public. You'll be surprised at what we discover when we look at various U.S.-generated public health information. Say the National Cancer Institute and their website, cancer.gov, well, they just, within the past month, did a new Cancer Trends Progress Report, -2009/2010. So this is state of the knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And it's state of the knowledge, all right, but it's the part of the story they tell. They tell the story that with regards to dioxin and cancer risk, that the amounts of PCDD, the most potent dioxin congener, but only one of 200-some, and only one of many more than 200-some dioxin and dioxin-like compounds, they tell the story that the levels of the PCDD are, you know, below the level of detection of the analytical technique based on this Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, you know, testing program. That is very deliberate deception of the public, because any reasonable scientist knows, and any reasonable person that, you know, reads the scientific literature knows, it has long been the, you know, the tradition and the only reasonable way to approach this to total a TEQ, this toxic molecule equivalent quantity, for the dioxins, the dioxin-like compounds, and the, which would include furans and cuprolin or PCBs. So to just put out there this one message about dioxin, that the levels of the TCDD are below detection limits, dirty business, you know, there's blatant, there's no question about it. They're not, you know, they're deliberately telling the public not to worry about dioxin when they should be worrying about dioxin. And then the National Cancer Institute, the worst people on earth could be doing that. It's really very criminal, and I intend to battle upon them until they take that off their website. But, you know, whatever. I'm just trying to help you understand how screwed up this thing is over here. You know, we've certainly got good government servants, but they're pretty low down. The ones at the top, there was a book called The Poison Conspiracy, written by Carl Grossman way back in 1983, and it showed what damage to the quality, you know, the character level of public servants was done by the Reagan administration when they placed these industry hacks in the top positions in EPA and FDA and all these different government departments that are supposed to be protecting us from the poison. And, you know, it's not good. But just go on to these questions. I don't want to overdo this. The International Cancer Union will be conducting a conference on world cancer burden in August of this year. Will IARC representatives be in attendance at this conference? And if so, what message will IARC bring before the International Cancer Union concerning the use of science in the prevention of cancer?
Well, IARC scientists will be attending that meeting in Geneva. I think it's in August. And we basically do cancer research to identify causes of cancer and so that preventive actions can be taken. We don't really go at this as an advocacy group. We basically want, we go there as a resource of
right.
What are the known or plausibly suspected causes of cancer, and then they formulate recommendations. And
interesting. So that International Cancer Union, they consider it their, one of their roles to make recommendations on cancer prevention for the future?
I think that's probably some of what they do.
I
can't really speak about all of the activities of that organization, but IARC does have a good working relationships with that organization,
okay.
And they do look to us for information about the preventable causes of cancer.
Okay. Yeah, see, one thing that caused me to have a little bit of concern about that organization was I just noticed that they've recently, you know, named a former CEO of the American Cancer Society to the top position with the International Cancer Union. And the reason that I have concern about that is that in October of 2009, ACS published this position paper on cancer and the environment, this perspective of ACS on cancer and the environment, and they made it clear, you know, anyone that read that would conclude that there was nothing known about exposure to pollutant carcinogens, which could be used to educate the public in order to bring about risk reduction. You know, it's very, very clear in that document. So I'm just thinking they're going to be kind of a, they're not going to be a very receptive audience, you know, to anything that you might share with them about these gestational dioxin exposures and the need to reevaluate the dioxin exposure cancer risk pursuant to possibly lowering the tolerable monthly intake for dioxins and dioxin-like compounds. It does seem that there certainly are a lot of powerful institutions which are not responsive to these concerns.
Well, I think if you take a step back and look at the broader global burden of cancer, probably at least a third of cancer is caused by tobacco use. And another 20% or maybe 25% of cancer comes from infectious diseases, hepatitis viruses, human papillomavirus, HIV virus. And so there are a large portion of the cancer burden can be eliminated through things that we already know. And so American Cancer Society, the UICC, it's good that some of their effort really is on these major causes of cancer that are contributing, 5, 10, 30% of the world cancer burden. Now, it's not to say that we shouldn't say that the industrial chemicals that people are exposed to on the job or in the environment don't have a contribution.
But don't you consider the cancer imposed, the cancer risk and the cancer cases that are kind of created due to that risk that are a result from exposure, all life stages, all peoples, all socioeconomic statuses, all jobs, all environments, which certainly are none of them pristine any longer, and that do end up imposing body burdens of chemicals like dioxins and PBDEs, these brominated flame retardants, and the bisphenol A, and this unbelievable number of either known or suspected human carcinogens. Don't you think that imposes a major quantity of cancer risk in the world as well as in the U.S.?
I think that they probably do impose some kind of cancer burden, and one way
well,
to know that is that
burden.
One way to know that is that other chemicals that are well regulated right now did cause a high cancer burden in workers or in some other populations that were observed. And so we do know that chemicals can cause cancer, and you don't have to find them in cigarettes or other environments to for them to cause cancer. The difficulty is that there's so many chemicals, and you talk about removing some pesticides, they'll be replaced by other pesticides. You talk about removing a couple of major chemicals in plastic, but they will be replaced by other chemicals to do the same function. And what you want to do is really identify that these are bad actors that ought to be eliminated. I think that eventually science will get the right answer, and I think science will get the right answer faster if there's less political interference in the scientific process. But it's really very difficult to say that certain chemicals ought to be banned right now, because I don't necessarily know that how much of a cancer, a driver they are for the world cancer burden, and I don't know that there are better alternatives.
Yep. Well, just say, for example, the way I look at it is you just take the best shot you've got, and as far as there being so much known that we both agreed upon about dioxin exposure cancer risk, why wouldn't it be just the reasonable thing to do for a major push to be undertaken throughout the world, because lots of people eat animal fat, just to tell the public, just simply educate the public about, if the public was educated about what you and I know right now today, there would be a considerable difference in exposure to some of these chemicals that are well known to cause significant amounts of cancer risk. And that's not happening. That's not even close to happening in the U.S., let alone in the world.
Well, more information is certainly, I fully agree that all scientific knowledge ought to be made available to the public, and that it should be made available to the public in terms that members of the general public can understand.
Exactly.
I mean, the reports we write here at IARC, risk assessments written by government agencies, are generally still written for a scientific audience, and that I would like to see more of this information brought to the general public. The way a lot of nutrition information, people know a lot of the principles of good nutrition, but even so, it's difficult to change people's habits, because I think we all know some of the causes of obesity and some of the causes of the dietary factors that increase heart disease or increase colon cancer, but it's still difficult to get people to change their ways. Some of that is economic. It's cheaper to eat junk food than to eat healthy food. A lot of good quality food is priced higher, and it's just also often difficult just to get people to change habits. And there's also a risk of an overload of too many messages.
Because
then people start to say, well, okay, you tell me a dioxin causes cancer, and last week you told me PCBs cause cancer, and the week before you told me some solvent caused cancer. Everything causes cancer.
That's the
message I don't want people to get.
They don't want to say that everything causes cancer, but they want to say a lot of things cause cancer, because that's the true story. There's a difference.
Well, actually, if you really look at it, there's maybe 50,000-100,000 chemicals in commerce, and you're not exposed to 100,000 chemicals every day. But you're exposed to traces of probably a few hundred, and you're exposed to larger amounts of a few dozen. And it's important to really test those.
Yep.
There's probably a couple thousand chemicals that have been tested for carcinogenicity. Our list of carcinogens includes about 100 known carcinogens and 400 probable and possible carcinogens. That's a really small fraction of the total number of chemicals in commerce. So I don't want people to get the message that everything causes cancer. And there's really.
And that's what I mean. I don't want them to get the message either. But see, my point is that they still think it's a big number, that 100 and possibly 500 chemicals causing cancer. That's a big number, even though it's not as big as the 100,000, but it's still a big number. But it shouldn't cause people to be disempowered and just kind of give it up and, just throw up their hands in the air or pull their skirt up over their head. They got to know that the true and correct facts of the matter are that this is not it's a big number, but it's not a huge number.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly with good efforts, something can be done about this. IARC publishes a series, these IARC handbooks on cancer prevention. Do you foresee a day in the near future when there will be an IARC handbook of cancer prevention focusing on dioxins and dioxin-like compounds?
I think that the focus of the handbooks on cancer prevention are activities that an individual citizen can take for themselves.
Exactly.
The past higher cancer prevention handbooks have been breast cancer screening, physical activity, avoidance of sun exposure, consumption of fruits and vegetables, and whether they have an impact on cancer risk. And these are things that you and I could start doing right now.
Exactly.
But you and I can't really, effectively know what our dioxin exposure is and how to control it. We know it comes from animal fats, and we can reduce our animal fats.
It's so simple.
There's other reasons to reduce animal fats as well.
For
nutrition. The way IARC would get the message out on dioxin would be my program, the Monograph program, which identifies known, probable, and possible causes of human cancer. And we have identified dioxin as a known cause of human cancer. And I think that the message there is that it would be good to reduce dioxin exposure and prevent dioxin exposure where possible. But sometimes that's not really at the citizen level. That's sometimes
That's very different. Why is it harder? Why is it okay to say fruit and vegetables, eat this for cancer prevention? What's wrong with saying just don't eat as much animal fat? You're halfway there already by telling them to eat the fruit and vegetables. They just can't keep packing in, more fruit and vegetables and eat all the same amount of meat at the same time anyways. I think it's truly a reasonable message to put before the public, something they can, exactly like you say, do it yourself. you know, the government's not possibly going to, like, get these levels down sufficiently. Just let's have the science in the public domain at, you know, a degree of complexity that they can understand, and just tell them the simple and true crux of the matter that dioxins are in all of the animal fat, that considering the big picture, there's too much cancer risk imposed by the amount of dioxins that are in the animal fat based on, you know, current levels of consumption, and people should make a serious effort to greatly reduce. Our recommendations are to restrict animal fat intake to little or no animal fat, considering, and see, it's not just the dioxins. That's what I'm, you know, concerned more about. It's all these persistent organic pollutants that are carcinogenic, like the PCBs, like the PBDEs, whether they are carcinogenic or in animals or in humans or whatever, it's not well understood. But as you make the point, there's always a new chemical coming along. You're never going to know all that. Just considering the fact that there are a considerable number of chemicals known or suspected as human carcinogens in animal fat, it's just such a reasonable, it's a no-brainer almost, just to tell people, stop eating so much animal fat because of all this poison in the animal fat. It's so easy.
I think that, let me give you a slightly different perspective on this. I think that when IARC would look at consumption of animal fat or consumption of fats in general, we would probably tend to do it not on a compound-by-compound basis, but we do have dietary studies that look at differences in different kinds of diets.
Yep.
And there are studies that do compare a diet with a lot of animal or meat consumption versus red meat consumption, white meat consumption, fish consumption, animal fats through things like dairy products and eggs. So there are different ways of doing that.
But see, that's two different.
And
two different.
Those are the types of studies we would do. For example, I could give you the... I'm not sure that we would want to necessarily say animal fat because you know, the nutrition literature is very, very rich with studies that show that certain fish oils can be part of a healthy diet.
I know it. And that's fine.
And so a message to avoid all animal fats would tend to also give the message, you know, don't eat the fish and don't eat the fish oils. And
I know it.
And that's, so IARC's recommendation on diet are generally going to come from dietary studies where we compare people who eat red meat with people who eat white meat versus people who eat no meat at all, versus people who fish, just dairy. And we would try to make recommendations based on that, but we wouldn't do it based on that there is dioxin in this fat from red meat or there's PCBs in the fat from fish. We really would be, I think, looking at the overall diet and not going to a chemical-by-chemical basis.
Well, not chemical-by-chemical. See, I was saying that whole group of persistent organic pollutants, there were numerous ones of them carcinogenic or suspected to be carcinogenic. I see what you mean. I totally see what you mean. But it just
But see, it's everywhere.
Missing.
And I can also probably, we could probably also take traces of, you know, do chemical analyses on what comes up in food crops and say,
certainly.
Well, we don't want to eat any strawberries because they have benamil, and we don't want to eat any...
But see, that's not the case. You're kind of...
I'm taking what you said to
somewhat raising
a
matter that's confusing due to complexity, which is not really truly fair. The fact of the matter is we know so much. Sure, we don't know very much maybe about those pesticides in the strawberries, but we know so much about these pollutants in the animal fat. It just seems like if we're going to do the right thing ever, here is the moment in time that's before us to do the right thing about chemicals. See, it's a different story. I get this all the time. These people in the New York State Department of Health, they're always saying, but Don, we already tell the public to restrict their animal fat consumption. But see, they never put it all together. They never say because of the poison in the animal fat. They just say because of the other effects of the animal fat. Well, people need a lot of good reasons for changing big parts of their behavior, such as consuming animal fat. People will be so much quicker to stop consuming animal fat if they knew that just the simple realities of what is known at the current date, the day we're talking right here, about dioxins and cancer risk, they would stay away, but I'm sure a lot of them would. See what I'm getting at? It's just that the whole story needs to be set before the public, not just part of the story, or like that it's good enough, because, see, it's not good enough. The science doesn't just say that animal fat itself imposes cancer risk, and how do they know how much of the cancer risk that they've seen that's being imposed by animal fat is caused by the animal fat itself and this endogenous estrogen kind of effect of animal fat itself, or how much is being caused by the poison that's in the animal fat, the dioxins, the PCBs, the old pesticides like DDT, you know, the 2,4-5-T, all these different chemicals. How can, you know, there's no scientist knows that. It'd be just so much simpler just to tell the public, okay, these chemicals that cause cancer are in the food supply. They're in animal fat in particular. This is a no-brainer. This is really easy for you to do. Just back off the animal fat and just cut out a lot of poison out of your diet every day. It's not like the thing with the strawberries and the little bit of, you know, whatever you said was on them.
Yeah.
It's a huge difference. You know, so, and I'm willing to, you know, discuss with you. I have one more question. And is it okay? This is not the a question you had before, but I just kind of came up with it yesterday. So if you don't want to answer it, fine. Just let me run it by you. The Joint Food Agriculture Organization / World Health Organization Expert Committee on Food Additives, this JACFA, next meets in Geneva, Switzerland during early June of 2010. The agenda of the meetings have been set, and they do not include reevaluation of dioxins and dioxin-like compounds, focusing on the new science concerning dioxin exposure cancer risk, all this pursuant to establishing a lower provisional tolerable monthly intake for dioxins. Did IARC make any requests to the WHO or any other entity such as the Codex Alimentarius for a reevaluation of dioxins and dioxin-like compounds due to the magnitude of dioxin exposure cancer risk, which has become apparent in the scientific literature since the provisional tolerable monthly intake for dioxins was established in 2001?
We generally don't make recommendations of what to put on the agenda. The way IARC talks about risk factors for cancer is we evaluate them, and we evaluate them when there are new studies out there that might indicate the cancer risk is different from what we had previously believed.
Okay.
We have spoken on dioxin to say that it is a known human carcinogen, and I mean, I think that would go towards making it one of the priorities, how that compares with other priorities that JACFA might be evaluating, whether there's a lot of unevaluated chemicals they're looking at for the first time. I really don't have enough information about their agenda and how they set it to know that they might be doing a fine job.
Okay. Well, then one more quick question, just to kind of follow up on that one. Thanks for answering that. I'd like to know why IARC hasn't reevaluated dioxin then, because you just said that you'd be interested in doing that. And it, the date of the IARC dioxin monograph is 1999. That's over 10 years old, and all the good science about what we've been talking about all day, you know, all during this interview, has been published since that date, except for there was a study published in Germany by this Heiko Becker and their labs looking at the quantification of dioxin exposure cancer risk due to the factory workers' exposure. That was published in 98. But then, it's probably not in there. It was, you know, there's no cutoff all that close to the date of publication for the science. It's not close. I suspect that paper wasn't in there. I don't think there's anything about quantitative risk assessment in the IARC monograph on dioxins. And why isn't there anything in there?
Okay, IARC doesn't do quantitative risk assessment because I think there's enough work to do just to identify causes of human cancer. And it really would probably consume more than half the resources of the program to do the quantitative risk assessments. And then we wouldn't be identifying as many causes of human cancer.
See, I don't mean that.
But
I don't mean to do the risk assessment. I mean to just look at the science that's already been done and take a position on it.
Actually, it involves different expertise. We bring in epidemiologists and toxicologists, and they're really more into the qualitative, does this cause cancer, rather than the modeling of what the cancer risks might be at various levels of exposure. But let me tell you, we have actually looked at dioxin more recently.
Okay.
In October last year, we had a meeting where we looked at many of the industrial chemicals that have already been known to cause human cancer. We wanted to do this with the idea of updating the database. And so dioxin was one of the chemicals that we looked at. We had a lot of meetings last year where we updated the database on all the known carcinogens, and it's going to take us through the middle of next year, I think, to go through the papers from those meetings and prepare the books for publication. You should see that book for publication sometime in the latter half of 2011.
So what's the title?
It's just the Iyer Monograph, Volume 100.
So how would anybody know what it was about?
How would they know it was about? Well, it's called A Review of Human Carcinogens, and
okay.
If you look at the table of contents, you'll see probably that volume, there were about 30 industrial chemicals that you'll see, and each one that will have about 10 to 50 pages or so summarizing the epidemiology and experimental studies. But we also published a two-page summary of that meeting, I think it was in December 2009, in Lancet Oncology. It was one of the leading cancer journals worldwide.
Yep.
And when we made we published all of our new findings in Lancet Oncology within 6 to 8 weeks after one of our meetings, so everybody can see that. And one of the agreements we made with Lancet Oncology when we send them these articles is they have to make them open access to everybody, including non-subscribers to their journal.
And so could you email me the link for that particular document? That'd be cool.
Yeah. All we'll have on dioxin, I think, is basically a row in the table that says it was reaffirmed as a cancer hazard. It'll have that I think it causes an increase in the risk of all cancers combined. And one of the special things about dioxin, the 1999 assessment classified dioxin not because we had sufficient epidemiological information, but because we had good epidemiological information that wasn't conclusive. But they looked at all the experimental evidence and said the experimental evidence is enough to tell us that this is really known to cause cancer. When we looked at dioxin last fall, the human evidence has strengthened, and we called it sufficient evidence in humans. And dioxin is the first chemical that started out with a classification that was based on a combination of human and experimental data, and now has been that the human evidence is strong enough to classify it by itself. This shows that the experimental information really was strong enough to tell us that dioxin was a cancer hazard 10 years ago, and unfortunately the human results have caught up with it.
So you're saying that dioxin is the first chemical that's ever been, this has taken place with?
It's the first chemical for which we originally called it a human carcinogen based on a combination of human and animal data. And now the more recent epidemiological studies that have been published confirm with experimental findings for telling us that dioxin does cause cancer in humans.
Okay.
Most cases we find the first indications are from, the strongest indications are from epidemiological studies. That's where we knew that arsenic caused cancer. That's where we knew that tobacco smoke caused cancer. That's where we know that alcohol causes cancer. That's where we know that hepatitis viruses cause cancer, not from building up an experimental case. In the case of dioxin, there's so much experimental work that's been done, and it all points in the direction of human carcinogen, that 10 years ago, when IARC looked at it, it was classified as a human carcinogen based on a combination of the epidemiology and the experimental results. The epidemiology has strengthened since then, as have
right.
the experimental results.
Just, one more quick question then. Will this update that has been already published and then the, the Monograph 100, which will be published in, I think you said 2011, will that include anything about this fetal origins of cancer, this gestational exposure to dioxin?
I would have to check that. I really don't. We did so many chemicals at that meeting that I can't talk off the top of my head about what particular studies were important in the committee's deliberations.
Okay. Well, see, then I guess I'm just still trying to figure out who the right government entity is to make the request to JECFA, this joint FAO-WHO expert committee on food additives, who the right government people are to go to ask that they would, call upon JECFA to reevaluate dioxins based on this new science, because that 2001 evaluation, missed all of this new science on the gestational exposure. And you know what the matter of fact is? It's even worse than that. They base every conclusion they set forth in that JECFA, paper on their conclusion, which is incorrect, that there's a threshold for dioxin exposure. And then just after 2001, I think it was in 2002, a paper was published that made it very clear that there is not a threshold, and many scientists now agree that there is not likely to be any threshold for dioxin exposure. So that alone, let alone all that gestational science, would argue for reevaluating dioxins pursuant to lowering the TDI, that tolerable monthly intake.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, there's a case I think you should be very proud of your EPA scientists. I think their assessment really does discuss the issue of threshold and that.
Would they be the right people to lobby then or advocate
I don't know JECFA's process. I don't know where they how they set their priorities. I don't know that EPA would necessarily be influential in JECFA's processes.
Okay. It is so complex, first started looking around and
you wouldn't have the information about dioxin having likely to have no threshold if you didn't have a lot of research that was done at EPA and at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences.
They're very good.
Both of those agencies really did that work that established the low-dose concerns for dioxin. So I think you really should give some credit to some of the civil servants you have doing science at government agencies, because without them, you would not have the case to be made that there's likely to be no.
They're doing part of the job, that's for sure. And I do want to say that we truly honor, we very much honor the old EPA scientists I shouldn't say old. No woman would like to say that about her. But the more seasoned, with a history EPA scientists like Dr. Linda Birnbaum and Dr. Suzanne Fenton, and now they're both at NIEHS, this National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And, we honor them tremendously. Dr. Birnbaum was the first person that we interviewed for our program here. So, and we've done the same 40-some, shows since this spring. But Dr. Birnbaum was talking to me in May of, 2009, so she was a good person to start with.
I bet she gave you a good interview, too.
She certainly did. She said she's going to help us try to move the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to start educating the general public about dioxin exposure cancer risk. So that was a huge step,
Well, we have good people at the top of agencies now. You know that she's been named the head of NIEHS.
Yep, yep.
So I think things, I'm actually very optimistic that things are improving in the last year or so, and will continue to improve.
Well, it's good to end on a good vibe. Thanks a lot for this interview. I will honor you. You are the most pleasant person to talk to. Just the most straightforward and stating the science as it exists type person that I've talked to about, cancer, quantitative cancer risk assessment. You're the best in any of the government groups by far, that I've talked to. Because, I just didn't get into this subject area with Dr. Birnbaum. She was very good on the gestational dioxin exposure and the cancer risk imposed by that in animal models. And Suzanne Fenton was very good on that, too. And they're both government scientists that deserve a lot of honor. And you certainly are a government scientist that deserves to be honored also.
Oh, well, thank you very much for that.
Well, thanks a lot. Hope you have a great day.
Oh, thank you. You too.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.